lightning flashpoints generously shared with us through the auspices of KPFA in Berkeley and Pacifica Radio with host Dennis Bernstein with an update on the impeachment of the South Korean president. Plus, we'll hear from peace activist Medea Benjamin. At 11 on a special episode of Digital Divide, we hear a conversation with Howard Bloom, author of The God Problem. And we just heard, and I'm going to remind you yet again, all new and increasing gifts to KBOO are matched one-to-one through the end of the year. Big thanks to the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Again, the place to go, kboo.fm. Click on the word donate. It's right there in the banner at the top of the homepage. And now, as promised, here is Flashpoints.
And you're listening to Flashpoint. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Well, we're going to know the results in just a couple of hours in terms of if the South Korean parliament has decided to impeach the president of that country. This is a huge scandal in the context of the changing of the guard in the United States. The United States with a major geopolitical strategy in line with South Korea, counting on South Korea. So this is a very touchy moment in history. We'll know the results. We'll come back on Monday to do more extensive reporting, but we just wanted to make sure we kept the story marked and on your mind because we think it's an important one. KJ, no, welcome back to Flashpoints. We don't have a lot of time. Remind people where we are in terms of the president and what's happening now, what comes next.
Yes, thank you, Dennis. Park Geun-hye is the president of South Korea. As you know, there have been massive protests in the streets.
Vigils.
Vigils. Millions of people asking her to step down. She currently has about 4% approval. And every Saturday, there are millions of people hitting the streets saying that she needs to be impeached. The question is essentially legitimacy of her. She comes to the presidency with very little legitimacy as the daughter of a dictator, but also she's been ensnared in a corruption and influence peddling scandal, namely that she had a close associate, Choi Soon-sil, who is a shaman who was not only giving her advice on hair, fashion, and clothes, but was also telling her how to run affairs of state, which cabinet members to hire, how to manage the budget, and how to dictate foreign policy.
And whose friends to include in the process. This was cronyism in the extreme.
Absolutely. So she was shaking down. She was using her influence with the president to shake down some of the largest conglomerates in South Korea. And she, you know, raised tens of millions, apparently about $72 million for personal enrichment to dubious foundations. And all of this is part of the kind of fascist military corporate nexus that is really part of South Korea's political economy. It's just been revealed in its full nakedness, and people are outraged and saying that Park needs to resign, and hence we have this impeachment vote.
Now, impeachment means they take her, they remove her from office pending a inquiry.
Well, essentially the way that it happens is that South Korea's parliament has to initiate a motion to impeach her. This motion has already been passed, and now the parliament has to vote, and 200 out of the 300 members have to vote to approve this impeachment motion. Currently, the motion is being voted on right now. We'll know the results of this early in the morning in the United States. Essentially, by tomorrow morning, we will know. But it's expected that with the 171 opposition members who want her impeachment and 29 ruling party members, they will have the impeachment vote. Once that passes, then what will happen is that Park Geun-hye will have to step down. Her prime minister will become a caretaker prime minister. And then the Constitutional Court of South Korea has 6 months to rule on the validity of this impeachment vote.
Okay, now what you know, just in a minute or two, what are the implications in the context of the close working relationship that the U.S. has developed with what we call the pivot, the Pacific pivot, and the fact that you've got a new president-elect who's already hired three generals and is going for a fourth general? It would seem to me that he would be ready for war in the region.
Well, it's, you know, there's some unknowns there, but what is known is that Park Geun-hye has been a very loyal executor of U.S. policy design in East Asia, namely that, you know, she has gone ahead with the building of the military base. She's gone ahead against massive opposition against the implementation of the Terminal High Altitude Missile Defense System. She rammed through the Comfort Women Agreement. And all of these things have to do with the remilitarization of Asia in opposition to China, namely South Korea being used as a beachhead and Japan being used as a kind of an unsinkable aircraft carrier in order to kind of offensive, to mount an offensive against China and to encircle it.
So there are many issues going on here. It also happens to be around the anniversary of what have been known as the Comfort Women. That's a misnomer, of course. It's about mass torture supported by the United States government and carried out by Japan. I guess this is a meaningful moment to the folks fighting for that recognition, for that suffering, given that this president has been vicious and unfriendly to the cause.
Absolutely.
And we have a guest, I believe, on the phone now. Just for a moment, Judge Lillian Singh has been big on this. Maybe she wants to say something about what's going on now and why this would be important in this context.
Yes,
are you there, Judge?
Yes, I am here, and I want to tell you that I was in Korea about a month ago, and I witnessed the millions of people that demonstrated against Park Geun-hye, and the vigil was so emotional. The citizens of Korea were just outraged by this president's outrageous corrupt conduct. So it's very, very interesting to see that we are going to have a Nanjing. It is an annual vigil of remembrance and a vigil of commitment to honor the 300,000 victims of the Nanjing massacre who were tortured, murdered, and many raped by the Japanese imperial government during World War II. After 79 years, Japan has not apologized. We're going to have a vigil and remembrance this Sunday in San Francisco at the Chinese Culture Center, 750 Kearney Street, third floor. I'd like to invite everyone who is free to take a moment out of their busy schedule and come and help us remember the 300,000 victims that were massacred and never got an apology. And also, I want to tell everyone that the document of Nanjing Massacre was accepted and now inscribed on the memory of the World Register by the International Advisory Committee of UNESCO's Memory of the World program, and yet Japan still denies this history. Japan is threatening to withdraw as UN fees as a protest for the United Nations UNESCO's Memory of the World program to register and inscribe what happened 79 years ago to Nanjing in what we call the Chinese Asian Holocaust.
All right.
So thank you for giving us the time to tell your audience about this. And I urge them to please remember the massacre victims like we remember the Holocaust of Europe. Please come and help us remember the Holocaust of Asia.
All right. Judge Lillian Singh, retired Superior Court judge in California, very focused on this issue. Thanks for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. KJ, thank you. We're going to have more information about this on Monday. We know the rest of the world isn't reporting about this, but here on Flashpoints, we understand that this policy, the administration in charge in South Korea, their complicity with the U.S. Pacific pivot. This is huge in this moment of in the age of Trump and facing the China century. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Now we're going to change the subject a little bit, but it really includes the world that we have been talking about, and that's well, we're joined by Ellen Schrechter. She is a retired professor of American history at Yeshiva University. She's the leading author on McCarthyism. Her books include Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. And well, Professor, it's good to have you with us on Flashpoints. You said today, let me just say a little bit about what you were saying earlier today. You said, in many ways, a new form of McCarthyism could appear. Trump advisor Newt Gingrich has called for a new House on American Activities Committee to target Islamic extremists. Meanwhile, proposed blacklists of anti-conservative professors, allegedly Russian-oriented websites, and who knows what else are sprouting up within the mainstream. And if we think about personalities, we should recall that McCarthy himself was often out of control. Trump, McCarthy, yes. You go on to say, but what is critical and what is poorly understood is how what we call McCarthyism depended on the willing collaboration of liberals and moderates who normalized its anti-communist hysteria. You say Hubert Humphrey not only backed the Internal Security Act of 1950, originally sponsored by Richard Nixon, but even added provisions for concentration camps for communists. Those were the liberals. Professor, why don't you just sort of paint us a picture? How are you evaluating your concern? What do you find compelling in terms of this, what you would consider as the new McCarthyism? What are you looking at? What are you looking at in terms of the evolution here?
Well, I'm sort of looking at it within the perspective of political repression within the United States, which has a long history and obviously manifests itself in a number of different ways. McCarthyism in the 1950s was a drive to eliminate the supposed influence of American communism. It operated in a whole bunch, through a whole bunch of different mechanisms, congressional committees, the FBI was very important during this period, and it worked to really silence most of the voices on the left. Just to give you an example, I used to teach a course on the United States since 1945. I would teach about the Korean War in the early 1950s. And it was a very unpopular war, just like Vietnam. And I would ask my students, well, let's talk about the anti-war movement during the Korean War. And I would get silence. And I'd say, yes, that's the right answer, because it occurred during the McCarthy period, so that even a deeply unpopular war was going on without any open opposition, really, outside of the very beleaguered far left. So what we're seeing now is obviously not an exact replay, although there are a number of these new blacklists that seem to be appearing on one's internet account rather prolifically these days. But also, I think there's the sense that people are going to be targeted in some way for some kind of unspecified repression, and that I think what will happen unless we fight back, and the fight back has to include the liberals, it has to include even moderates, it has to include the Democratic Party, which doesn't particularly want to, whose members are not particularly eager to engage in a quote-unquote fight. But of course, they've been under attack for so long, you would think by the right wing of the Republican Party, which is now in ascendancy, that you would think they would be willing to shed some of that, what could we call it, respectability, and really fight to defend our rights, which are seriously under attack.
Now, I want to pick you up on this now. I'm sure you're familiar with these so-called fake news scandal, if you will, that's being perpetrated by the Washington Post, which is now reporting freely about an anonymous group now of former government officials and unnamed professors who are going to get together and decide exactly what the truth is and what the truth isn't. They're already naming some of the most significant and alternative websites that we have that help us counteract the kinds of lies that are perpetrated by the New York Times and the Washington Post that get us into big wars like in Iraq. It's not only that you've got to get the Democratic Party on your side. They're the ones who are trying to make excuses for the poor candidates they put forward and the collaborations they had with the corporate press, who just loved an election where they could sell a lot of airtime, and sell the rest of the world Donald Trump. It is a huge problem when you've got the Clinton establishment trying to use phony news and all that to blame the alternative press because they screwed up.
Well, I think that's certainly a big piece of it. And that's what, in my research on McCarthyism, I sort of was most concerned about, is this collaboration of the mainstream with a lot of extremely repressive behavior. For example, I did a whole book on universities. And what was happening in the 50s and what could happen today is people were being called up by congressional committees and quote-unquote